will convene the Rosenthal Public Safety Club for Thursday, April 15th. Continue our public hearing on Senate Bill 5517, the Oregon Judicial Department budget.
Do you have any comments from staff?
Just a reminder to the committee that we're going to wrap up the public hearing component of this budget today, and then at some future point, we will be coming back into work session and get into detail on some of the specific issues.
Now, most of our questioners are absent, so they will not hear my pronouncement with regard to the department. You guys can go as quickly through your presentation today. I know we want to give Kingsley and the chief at least an hour, I'd say, to wrap up, and then maybe have some time for some questions. If we don't get to it, we will obviously get to the questions in work sessions. So, having said that, let me call up Chief Carson. And we'll talk a little bit about the Judicial Department Access Task Force.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Wallace Carson, the Chief Justice of the United States Court. It's going to be a joint assurance with Senator Gordley on access. If we roll it over, I really would like to have her pair of shoes. It has a building, a meeting outside the building, it's so pristine, and she'll be here as soon as we can. And if the start of the chair and members will just roll it down, and when she's here, we'll stop and have her do it.
We would be more than happy to accommodate Senator Gordley. You, however, sir, of course. let's jump right into Senator Kingsley.
For the record, just a couple of minutes to tell you just the top part, which is our today's fiscal plan guide for Thursday. The 99 didn't copy over, but
let me interrupt you. I love these. this is great. I mean, you've got your Chief Justice one-page budget, which I love, and then you're highlighting what you're doing each day, and that is very helpful to us. Thank you. Please proceed.
Today we're going to be speaking about the access issues. Some are in essential, some are in general funds, some are in mandated payments. We're going to talk about mandated payments budget, which is the jury and interpreter. And then we're also going to highlight very quickly the other policy issues that are in the Chief Justice's budget, so you know what is the concept behind the figure. I should probably just take a minute to tell you about mandated payments because that'll segue into the rest of the conversation. The second page to behind the Chief Justice's budget just tells you what our base current service level is for mandated payments. And as mentioned, primarily jury and interpreter costs. It also is our ADA accommodation costs and civil transcripts for indigents and civil arbitration fees for indigents, things that we've mandated to pay if people can't. The governor's recommended budget has $8.6 million in there. That takes care of our basic needs. And we do have new policy packages, and that's what we're going to be discussing today. I did do something with this handout since it's our last day. I did at the very end attach on page 6, just a breakout of our three appropriations. We talked about them on the very first day. We have operations, which is our trial court appellate and admin. We have mandated payments, and then we have indigent defense. So on page 6 of this little handout, it shows you the LFO allocation, which is really the agent allocation, the governor's budget number, then the Chief Justice's recommended, which is the $443 million, and the differences. You'll see, for the most part, the only place where we don't have what we consider essentials is in our operations level, and we'll be coming back to it. And pages 7 through 11, if you want to read it between now and when we come back to work session, is really our walk through of current service level and packages. But that's in mandated support interpreters.
Can you interrupt just half a second? Your essential package, not your essential packages, but your base budget, the 8.4, I'll call it 8.5, is, we can find that in our blue book someplace, what that's comprised of and broken down with?
Yes, there is a tab that says mandated payment.
That's okay, just as long as I know it's there. And it's under mandated payments?
Blue tab mandated payment starts on page 149.
In the dark blue cover.
In the dark blue cover.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the committee gets their quick reference. The current service level crosswalk for mandated payments is also in this packet on page 10.
Mm-hmm. That's what we're currently doing in the base mandated payment.
Yes.
Okay, great. Got it.
With that, what we're going to be primarily speaking about in this first 45 minutes is the access issues that relate to and cover mandated payments. And page 3 is a breakout of the items that cover interpreters, zeroing. We have one technology for the related translated forms, and then we just listed the legislative proposals that will probably end up in Ways and Means if they're not there already. That in fact, all three of those are in Ways and Means that deal with additional cost items in new policy packages. Interpreters. In 1995, the legislature passed an enactment that provided for the state court administrator to set up an interpreter, certified interpreter testing program in the court. This was also accompanied by requirements and changes in the law that required courts to use certified interpreters for hearings whenever a person did not have minimal understanding of the proceedings because of language. We started the program with actually grant money and cost sharing between the National Center for State Courts and three other states, because the cost of development of tests are like $25,000 a crunch, and if you keep using the same one, you know, the word gets out. So we formed a consortium under the National Center to share costs for development in testing in 8 languages, and we're still working on others. As of the fall of 98, there are 13 state court systems that are part of this consortium. We've had 551 workshops. We've given 4 tests since 95. We've had 211 tested, and we've had 61 become certified interpreters, and we have a couple more still working through the final process. We have 58 for the Spanish language, 2 for Russian, and 1 for Vietnamese. I've put there's a green handout, and I'm not going to read this today. It gives you one history on page 2 of the certified court interpreter programs, including our costs. We do recover all our costs for the workshops and for the testing. What we don't recover costs for is the staff. And that's a little bit of what we're going to talk about as far as our needs. On the page 1 is a summary of rationale for staff interpreter policy packages, and those go to court interpreters in the court system. In the administrative office, we have asked the essential for a program manager to carry forth our testing and certification program now that we've gotten this, what I would call, to a stable place of development. Really, that program started with me when I was a deputy, when Bill Linden left in January of 95, when testing began, and I took on acting. I turned to my assistant, Kathy Rhodes, here, and said, "Here, you got to take this the rest of the way." She has done an incredible job with her and with Gloriella Webster, who's with the Multnomah Courts and is a federal certified Spanish interpreter, as well as now a program manager for us, where we are sharing costs with Multnomah Courts to have her be statewide to help us with the development of court staff interpreters. We have asked for, we are asking for a person to continue the central coordination of this effort. We're not doing any testing this year because we have legislative sessions, and Kathy is an integral part of doing all our fiscal impact. We are asking for positions in the court to set up staff interpreters. This is really a cost shift. We're asking for $1.3 million out of our mandated payments to transfer to court operations to fund 15.5 interpreters. The reason is because we will save that much money and more by having staff interpreters. We decided to try and improve our case by using some of our mandated money this biennium to just in the last several months hire 4 staff interpreters in the court system, and we have Gloria, as I mentioned, we're providing money with Multnomah County to have her coordinate the effort. Kathy Rhodes has been doing some fiscal analysis of it. It's attachment. Attachment 5 in the handout, and that's the link handout. And that is page 8. She's projecting this on basis of use that we're saving 23.46% per day in our cost. And the reason for that is by having a staff interpreter on site, you don't have the downtime if the case cancels. They can do something else. They can translate forms. They can be used at the counter. They can be used in another proceeding. Right now, when we're scheduling freelancers, and we'll always have a need for freelancers, always, because there's not enough of the rest to do it. But by having someone centrally, you can pick up a bulk of the court's needs in a consistent manner day after day, and you can save costs and mandated payments. And that's why we're not asking for new money for that part. We're asking for a transfer of the funds to operations. We are asking for new money for the program manager and for the coordinator supervisor, because those positions aren't money we're spending now in mandated. I do have Judge Nancy Campbell in Washington, from Washington County, who has been instrumental also in helping us bring this program up and in inviting bench books for judges on how to use interpreters properly in the courts. And I'd like to give her a few minutes just to talk about why that matters.
Okay. Thank you. I am Judge Campbell. I simply said I'm from Washington County. And I think I initially became really aware of the need for interpreters and qualified interpreters when I was on the task force for racial and ethnic issues in the court system that Justice Peterson headed several years ago now. And at all of our hearings throughout the state, the primary focus of people's testimony was the lack of qualified interpreters in the court system and how they were not, how justice was not being met, and it really wasn't being. And you could see that, as a judge, you could certainly see that going on too and what was happening. A lot has changed, and a lot of that we can thank the legislature for, because you have changed some of our laws that now really require us to use certified interpreters whenever we possibly can, and the certification process is certainly weeded out some people that probably shouldn't be in the business. And
so we actually helped you?
Yes, you did, and you should be thanked for it.
Let's dwell on that a little bit. Yeah.
We are now looking at the need for staff interpreters, and I can tell you I see the need is great. Washington County is, of course, one of the larger counties in the state, and we do have interpreters we use every single day in the court system without fail. At arraignments, we always need Spanish-speaking interpreters. We have people that we have to have them there available at all times. But we also have an extensive need for interpreters. I was asked to speak yesterday afternoon. I got a phone call late in the day, so I delete my email a lot. But I looked through the email coming through that we all get, and I can tell you there was one that came in at 1:24. Interpreter needed ASAP, now please, hearing in process. Another one earlier in the morning saying they were going to need one in juvenile court that afternoon. Another one from the day before. Anyone seen an interpreter? We need an interpreter ASAP in 440J, etc. These come across. I know there's not a day that goes by that we don't see one of these blurbs come across our email, hoping that somebody will see an interpreter and send them. If we had a staff interpreter there, for one thing, they could coordinate with that person a little bit better. Also, we would have somebody to go and solve that need rather than the court having to delay the trial or the plea or whatever it is that's going on, which does happen. And, of course, that costs money. It's probably very difficult to measure how much money it costs, but it certainly is very costly when you think of all the staff being paid, the attorneys, et cetera, and judges. So I think that in that manner, a staff interpreter would be extremely helpful. Something else that comes up is often we have a need for a interpreter with one of the more unusual languages. And a staff interpreter could help cover the administrative need of finding one. They know what the court system means in the way of an interpreter. For example, we need somebody there that can interpret simultaneously. A lot of people cannot do that. They're interpreters. It's, I don't know if you know what that is, but it's very difficult. They are interpreting in the foreign language exactly at the same time they're talking. So they're hearing it in one language and interpreting at the same time. If you don't have somebody that can do that, it's almost impossible to work. I had a case recently where the woman wanted to enter a plea. She had an attorney. Our court tried to get an interpreter. They went through one of the language schools. The interpreter that was sent out did not interpret simultaneously. To give him credit, he had actually called our court, talked to a staff person, and was told, because the staff person didn't know what simultaneous interpretation was, oh, no, that's fine. If you speak the language, you're fine. Come on out. Well, that was clearly wrong. And we had to go over the ethics rules with them and so forth. I did try, because I thought it was going to be difficult if we have to reset. We could not go on. Because I would say a sentence. We'd have to interpret that sentence. I mean, it would have lasted, that hearing, it should have been a 15, 20-minute hearing, probably would have lasted an hour and a half, and I'm not exaggerating. It just was too cumbersome to handle, and I was concerned that he wasn't qualified well enough to even go through this person's rights with her. So we had to reset it. Somebody who is a staff interpreter can explain the needs and hopefully find somebody that can interpret properly in the court. There are people out there just finding them. That is an additional cost when we get somebody that comes out, and that does happen, not with a lot of frequency, but it does happen, and we can't use that person. And so then everything has to be reset, so you have another problem. Another thing that comes up, and I'm facing this, is here I have a death penalty case where the defendant does not speak English, and most of the witnesses do not speak English. The freelance interpreters do not want to sign on for a long trial, and this we're anticipating our motion hearing to take about 3 weeks in the fall, and then the trial's next year, and who knows how long it's going to take. It'll be several weeks. They will not, and we have a very difficult time getting interpreters for these cases because, number one, they can make more money somewhere else, and they don't want to sign up for 3 or 6 or 8 weeks, and suddenly maybe have the trial go away and get reset. And they have given up all that time. They've turned down another assignment. Whereas if we have a staff interpreter there, and we would, I'm going to tell you, we'd need more than one interpreter in that case. There's no question about it. But at least we would have that staff person there to coordinate the interpreters for that case, to back up what needed. And hopefully, and I would assume, would save money in the long run, very frankly, because they could be there keeping things going when other people really can't, who don't understand the process, and they know the interpreters. But that's going to be, I mean, from my standpoint, I'm very concerned about that when this trial comes up, because obviously in a death penalty case, you want... I mean, I'm insisting on certified interpreters. I mean, it's absolutely has to be. And we need to make sure that trial can keep going. You get a jury there that's already agreed to be there for maybe 6 weeks, for example. You don't want to have to stop in the middle of this because we don't have interpreters available. So that's another problem that comes up. I wish now we had staff interpreters. We are doing so much better than we were several years ago, and we are fortunate in our county that we do have interpreters that coordinate to be there every day. We have to have interpreters every day, and they are there for that they're not always there when they need them. And sometimes that's our fault, sometimes it's the attorney's fault. Sometimes, and this happens quite often, defendants come in saying, yes, I can speak English. They can speak English in the grocery store to get something and get directions, like some of us perhaps have been to foreign countries and have learned enough to get by. But they, you start talking to them in court, you know they didn't understand their rights. They don't even know what a jury trial is. And they really do need to have somebody who's highly qualified to interpret for them. We find that out, and then we try, that's when you get the, yeah, we have one as soon as possible here to get in, because you realize that they just do not understand what's going on. Any questions?
Right. Questions for the judge on interpreters? Their presentation.
Thank you.
She just came. Do you want to call the Bell's office and see if she's up there or you?
She had a self-esteem day.
I'm just going to tell you briefly what's in the rest of the policy packages for ACTRA. One you'll hear about when Senator Gordley and the Chief Justice come up here, there will be about a task force person, someone to help support the work of the Access to Justice Committee and the Department, someone to follow up on the recommendations that have been done in support of the Access to Racial and Ethnic Fairness Report, the Gender Fairness Report, and future reports that are coming up, as well as the Ombudsman for Racial Issues and Fairness Issues in the Court. I'll let them speak more to that position. We do have, under jurors, we have some one-day, one-trial costs that we're trying to absorb because we think that is one more customer service to people who are called to the jury service. And results also, it improves, I would say, representativeness on the jury panel because you can come in one day and the excuses go way down. We have a, also a package for our juror recognition program. That's partially there to offset the fact that we only pay $10 a day and 8 cents a mile. When you look down in the legislative proposals, you'll see two legislative proposals that are down in Ways and Means, and those have to do with increasing juror per diem or various the mileage and other costs that go with jury service. And those are the major ticket items in our policy packages. But I'm sure you'll have separate hearings on those. But the task force, the Chief Justice will also say why we care about that issue. In the technology beyond current maintenance, program maintenance, we do have something that says trial court forms, about $618,000. That was costing out the statewide forms and the cost of translators to translate these into languages we use.
What's the page you're on,
I'm sorry, I'm just talking from page 3 of our access proposal. I thought it was originally, back when we had couple of weeks, we were going to have people speak a little more in detail to each of these, but I thought I would highlight them instead, just because I know we're going to have to come back in work session and say, where do we spend the money and where does it get you the furthest? But this, I think, just by highlighting and alert you, that's one, they're there, if you want to get more detail, and two, shows you, I think, variations on what's happening in the justice system in the fairness area, especially with jurors and interpreters. Our citizen review court program, which you've heard about, I think about on the second day with Nancy Miller, they have asked for about $50,000 to use for a stipend to, we have, you know, volunteer, that the citizen review board, and they're all volunteer members, and part of the problem with getting better representation by economic class and by race is that is the fact that people have to contribute a couple of days a month, and if there was some way to pay some of the people who couldn't afford to do the service otherwise, we could improve who's on those panels so that when they see those cases, they can identify better with what's coming before them.
Explain that a little better. I mean, who's serving right now? What's a typical profile?
If Nancy's here, I would. I would say how it started out from junior league, but it's much different now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Nancy Miller, Citizen Review Board Director. Thank you very much for the sign that says, do not touch the microphone. You can read it now. Representative Minnis, currently our board members are about 91% Caucasian, 9% different minority groups. They are pretty much middle to upper middle class volunteers. These are people who can afford to take time away from work. What we did in working up this budget package was we looked at the poverty level numbers and did a percentage of the volunteers that we would like to have that are low income. And we're suggesting a stipend for maybe daycare for those folks, you know, something to give them some money that they could get a bus to come. One of the problems that we see, and we have some money in there for specialized minority recruitment. One of the things we found over the 12 years we've been in existence is that you cannot put an ad in the paper, do a spot on the radio, do a spot on TV, and expect to recruit minority board members. There's an inherent distrust of government. You have to be out in the community. I went to a One Church, One Child picnic in Northeast Portland, and I was sitting there next to the CASA folks who we shamelessly recruit next to because they ask for a bigger time commitment. Then we have a big sign that says one day a month for a child. So when people can't do CASA, then they come and talk to us. And I was sitting at this picnic, and this African-American lady came by, and she said to her adult daughter, this is a Citizen Review Board. It's a really good program. They didn't used to want black people, but they do now. And I was horrified. I mean, it's not that we didn't want minority board members. We were dying for minority board members, but we were not doing the specialized kind of recruitment that we need. So the population that we're serving, you know, there's overrepresentation of minorities in the foster care system and the juvenile justice system. And we're doing reviews in Portland, and we have folks from the African-American community coming in looking at five white faces. They're really questioning down deep inside whether these people understand and whether they're going to get a fair shake.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions for Nancy while she's up here?
Thank you.
I'll just mention the next question.
The only other one I was going to highlight in our pages is one that says public information officer. We already thought.
Are you still on page 3?
Still on page 3, and it's under the general access related, and it has four items: Supreme Court, PJ, Justice Initiative, Citizen Review Board. Oh, Multnomah, excuse me, I jumped over that. They're doing community courts in Portland, and that is been extraordinarily well received by the community there. It's where you hold the proceedings in the community where the crime was committed. They have to screen the cases, and then they usually do it in the evening when people can attend. But they have to be able to staff those and deal with all the case records and finishing up the processes out there. And they felt that with their current staffing level, that they've got a bit of a grant that's paying for it right now, but it really overstretches their current resources to keep doing that. But they put it in because the community seems to want it so badly here that they need it. And Doug Gray was here the other day to talk to us, and I can bring him back to him, if you want to hear more about that. It's one more area where the court is trying to respond to the community needs. We have a public information officer, and that we have for years never put a person like that in the budget, because it always does seem like a thrill. But then I hear Senator Kim say, no one knows what you do. No one knows anything about the court. You're the best case or worst case kept secret. And part of the idea of public information officer, especially in this day and age, is to be able to respond not only to media inquiries, but to provide, I would call, the public information documents and outreach programs that let the people know what other courts are doing and how they can be a part of it and how to be involved in improving how the courts deliver services, as well as be able to respond to the many inquiries that we have, as well as being able to help with the websites and getting information delivered. So that is the purpose behind that request. And she said, if you want to say anything more on the PIO or anything else.
So at one time, for the record, I'm Molly Carson, Chief Justice. Back in the 80s, Bob Gangwire was hired. He was retired from the Statesman Journal, probably Statesman at that time, and was hired and assisted Arnold Beneke. They had some groups, and it was found very useful to communicate with the public. You know, we're desperately aware that we need to communicate more, and I'll talk about that in my wind-up, more with the public, more with you on a level that before we engage each other in meaningful discussion. I always worry that I slip into legalese or jargon or bureaucratese. It's very easy for me and it's quicker. I use acronyms. That's my military experience as well. I have not turned many into verbs, which is the Pentagon phenomenon. But we really do need a person that can help us. I'll use the word market. That's not a bad word for me. I think it's a good word. And be able to tell the people what we do and respond to inquiries is. Said, I'll leave it at that. I think it's a legitimate request. We lost it in the budget cuts in the late 80s and have not gained it back, nor have we tried. This time, we think we're getting beat up, and we need to get a message out to the public. They may like it or they may not, but right now, they're getting the information from the courts and letters to the editor, and that's not a very good way to become informed. Do we want to go on the other?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's okay. I want to thank the committee again for allowing us to speak on this. This should have appeared first. And I apologize. I'd hope to be here with Senator Gordley for one particular reason. I'm going to sing her praises. I've enjoyed working with Senator Gordley. She has been an inspirational leader for us in this endeavor, along with former Chief Justice Ed Peterson, and moving the courts into a better understanding of access to justice for all. And she's been a delight to work with, and she has toiled here in the legislature as a representative, now senator, and also as a member of her community, her constituency. A great lady and a great participant in the delight. I'll repeat that to her privately, or may embarrass her to do it again. I also want to give credit to Leola McKenzie, who is our borrowed staff person. She actually works for state court administrator, but she is one of the brightest and most delightful people I've had a chance to work with on our Access to Justice Committee, and we couldn't have done what we've done, and I think we've done a lot. Let me just quickly go through this.
I'm going to make a stand up if you want.
Okay. All right. Pardon
me.
Okay, go ahead. You go.
The handout that we provide a handout on the assets and expenses of the state for the last several years, and that paper was kind of talks about the pieces it's going to talk about.
Near the end of the last decade, the National Conference of Chief Justices, which is an organization that worked out of the National Center for State Courts, it's a secretariat. It is akin to the National Council of State Governments or legislative leaders or whatever, and they meet twice a year in the 14 sessions I've been to one. I don't get out of state very often. I don't mean to downplay meetings. They're important, but I can read them at home. The Conference of Chief Justices for the Nation adopted a resolution advocating that each Chief Justice pursue problems of gender bias and racial and ethnic bias within the court system. when about the time that my predecessor, Ed Peterson, Chief Justice, was stepping down from his position, having done a wonderful job as Chief Justice in my view, he was very interested in this area, and we started and formulated a task force on racial and ethnic issues in the court. And then it moved into the justice system because we found that when we isolate, and some of the problems you might have been having, it's hard to isolate the court because we're part of a continuum. Most of the problems start somewhere else and end somewhere else. And so we broadened it, and I'll touch upon that. We had a, so we appointed a task force, and the first publication, they worked for about 2 years. The first publication is this one. I think you all have copies somewhere. If not, we still have some left. And this is a study that took us a little over 2 years. The report came out in May of 1994 and was fairly stinging about how we in the justice system are dealing with racial and ethnic issues in the court system. A word that's frequently used is representation, underrepresentation, overrepresentation. I'm sure you're aware, but that's kind of a buzz phrase to show that we're not, that what happens in the court system in various aspects is not represented in the ethnicity of the community. If you're talking about a 99% Anglo, European, Caucasian, then probably our juries match that. If you're talking about 11% African American, or you're talking growing issues of 14 or more in some of our communities, Hispanic, then the jury still frequently stays Caucasian. And Nancy has spoken, Ms. Miller has spoken to the issue of trust. You've all done it. There's a study that we've worked on in a study with a phone call, Blue Eye, Brown Eye. If you haven't had the opportunity, it allows you to put yourself.
Excuse me, Wallace, we have the best possible news.
The sheriff already won.
If I may, I'll repeat. We started without you, and the reason I waited so long because I wanted to tell you how much I appreciate working with you and what an inspiration. She's been nice to me, too, and that helped. What an inspirational member you have been way back when we were first working on this in the House and in the community, and now that you're in the Senate and a member of ACSA. Thank you very much for that, too. Appreciate it. Let me go on. She has the second part of this, and I'll just go on. This study then was done and published. It was a fairly scathing report in some areas about how we are doing our work in the system. And we, I mean law enforcement, I mean DA, defense counsel, law schools, Oregon State Bar, corrections, and a variety of others. They came up with 72 areas of concern. And the question is, I was touching on representation, and all that is a shorthand way of saying that in an ideal world, we're entitled to a jury of your peers. That means they all have to be 64-year-old Bush grade school graduates, but they should kind of look like or be like the community from which you, from which the jury is drawn. And for a variety of reasons, a bias perhaps, both in the gender area and others, and also economic. Other areas, our juries are not particularly representative. They're not as representative as they should be. That's our goal. I'm sure you join us in that goal. Anyway, this report, one of the things that we then did was to move to what we called an implementation commission. I think about 37 states have done a study. The one difference we want to have is we want to act on a study. We don't get the social concern off our back by publishing a paper that we have some problems and then walking away from them. We intended to do something about them. And we have the implementation committee, which is the next group, chaired by Paul Jimenez on the Court of Appeals, and they mapped out, put the 72 areas and mapped out how we are to move and make them a reality. Some have been successful in small measure. A seven-session particularly was very interested in large part in some of the work we were doing and was very helpful. But we directed our recommendations, as I mentioned, to a broad group, including the legislature and the governor and our own department. Yes, indeed, we have some need to have a little more rainbow in our own department. I think we're doing well, but we need to do better.
And then after the implementation committee, and both the implementation and the original task force committee recommended that we form an access or monitoring or oversight. And oversight in the legislative sense, that is somebody up over the shoulder. Oversight out in the outside world, I think, is probably understood as looking for mistakes and oversights. That we use it in the sense of monitoring, implementing, monitoring, and creating ways of reaching our goals for fairness and support and within the justice system. And that's the sense of the justice. At the same time, or toward the end of the access commitment, we also embarked on the second phase of the national program, and that was a gender study in cooperation with the Oregon State Bar, and we looked at some of our past feelings and partnerships in Portland for females and other problems. It was intended to be a look and say what things we're doing well in Oregon and what things we're not doing very well within the bar court system. Justice Susan C. Graber was the co-chair, along with Bob Frazier, a well-known past president of the bar, a lawyer from Eugene. She's now been elevated or transferred down to the Ninth Circuit, as most of you know, and it's a real loss to the Oregon court system. But she was co-chair of the Marvel's job, and this report came out in May of last year. All these reports then have been taken to the Access to Justice Committee, and it's currently chaired by Richard Baldwin, who is a lawyer in Portland, and a very good chair, and then Janice Wilson has recently been named as a vice chair of the committee, and it is the group that is monitoring, about which all these pieces are supposed to come together, assuming we have appropriate staff that we can keep it together so that we can move forward in our program. The report concludes on the gender side that Oregon has moved forward in the last 10 or 20 years, but we still have some ground to cover, and in law schools and partnerships in big firms, small firms, and in the system. And particularly in the area, most of the testimony, a lot of the testimony, was lingering concerns about gender bias matters in domestic relations and domestic violence. And so that's a concern of how we can, it may be more perception than reality, but as you know, in politics, those of us who are in politics, sometimes perception is reality. And particularly when it's sensitive, as it relates to justice, maybe you got justice, but you don't think you did, really didn't. That's the problem. Okay. So all of these now have been turned over to the Access to Justice for All Committee, and they're working on implementations. And what you see in the budget presentation that Kingsley and Nancy Campbell and others have presented are basically trying, and under Leola's, Kingsley's good guidance, the committee actually sat down and said, how are we going to do this? What is most important? And they're prioritized. I also plug again the Justice 2020, which you have seen, and heard about over the years. This was published in January 95. It says in there, the department's challenge is to ensure that no one is denied access to justice services due to social, cultural, linguistic, gender, age, and disability barriers. And that's our goal. And we will not stop until we reach our goal. As our population becomes more diverse, the problems that we have discovered and articulated are not going to go away. They're going to become more severe, more serious, and we need to move forward in this area. The court system, like the work we're doing, is anxious to do a better job in this area, and we need your support in that regard. I think I'll quit right there and turn it over to Adele, and I'll respond to questions if you have any.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I come to you this afternoon with new respect for my HMO. they gave me a little shot of life or something. That capital prayer that's going around is kind of getting us all down, and I've been revived. Glad to be here.
Senator, I just want you to know, for the record and on the record, that the Chief Justice's kind words that he reiterated in your presence are a mere shadow of the glowing compliments she bestowed you while you were absent. So if you are ever feeling a little bit down, maybe with the capital crud, I would get the tape and listen to what
the New York and the Supreme Court really feels about you. It is a compliment.
Thank you very much. I will say in preface to my prepared remarks that I'm very proud to be, for the record,
you made that little sign out loud.
Abel Gordley. representing Senate District 10 in Portland. I am very proud to be here today and to be from the state of Oregon and to be sitting next to our Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Oregon. Oregon is a state that is tackling some of the most difficult issues of our time. The Chief Justice has shared with you that reports have been issued, but these reports are not sitting on a shelf somewhere gathering dust. We all know that phrase, don't we? We have real people out there who are committed to ensuring that all Oregonians have justice, see justice, in the administration of justice. And these activities are occurring because of the quality of leadership that we see in Chief Justice Carson, and also I must say the name of former Justice Evelyn Peterson as well. So I sit here with a great deal of pride to be a part of a state that knows that yes, these are hard issues, but we're going to do something about them. And so what I would like to talk with you about this afternoon briefly is the Access Committee funding priorities. Thinking back over the past several years, I can see many positive changes that have occurred to increase access to the courts for racial and ethnic minorities. We have the development and implementation of a statewide certification program for court interpreters. There is the ability of courts to accept foreign language documents if they are accompanied by certified English translations, educational opportunities, and increased efforts by state agencies and the Oregon Justice Department to build culturally appropriate services in base budgets. More importantly, though, attitudes are changing. Non-minorities and minorities are beginning to work together to solve the problems of racial discrimination and ethnic bias in the justice system. As Chief Justice Carson indicated, it is imperative that we now provide the resources necessary for the Access Committee to take a statewide leadership role in access to justice. The staff positions for the Access Committee will advise the State Court Administrator, the OJD management team, leaders, and other justice-related agency management regarding access to justice issues. The professional staff will also provide technical knowledge and expertise by serving as an ombudsperson for complaints concerning racial and ethnic issues, in addition to investigating, tracking the progress, and responding to ADA-related complaints. The Access Committee has also given very high priority to packages regarding interpreters. Kingsley Click will discuss the statewide staff interpreter positions and statewide program manager positions with you. However, I would like to draw your attention to Senate Bill 71, that has been referred to this committee from the Senate Judiciary Committee with a due pass recommendation, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 71 requires courts to provide interpreters for the non-English speaking parents of youth involved in delinquency proceedings. Currently, interpreters are only provided for the non-English speaking parents guardians of youth at the dispositional phase. This bill will increase access to the courts for the non-English-speaking parents of youth in the juvenile court. The parents this bill helps are those whose children speak English. By providing parents with interpreters for court proceedings, judges do not need to second-guess whether or not youth are interpreting court instructions correctly to parents. The committee sees this as an important bill that will enable parents to communicate effectively with the court and return the power and decision-making back to the parents. Jury initiatives are also priorities for the Access Committee. Juror per diem and mileage rates have not been raised in Oregon since 1971, although there have been several attempts in prior sessions that have floundered on the funding issue. Instead of combining these into one bill with a fiscal impact of $11.5 million, as has been done in the past, the Access to Justice for All Committee recommended two separate bills, Mr. Chair and Committee. One bill increases mileage reimbursement and the real cost paid to jurors, such as parking, dependent care expenses, lodging, at Senate Bill 17. And the other bill includes only an increase in the per diem, that's Senate Bill 62. This greatly reduced fiscal impact to $2.2 million to $5.4 million for each bill. Let me say that again. This greatly reduced the fiscal impact to $2.2 million to $5.4 million for each bill. Senate Bill 17 and Senate Bill 62 have been referred to this committee from the Senate Judiciary Committee with a due pass recommendation. The main purpose of these bills is to relieve some of the economic hardships of jury service that may now affect both the level of representativeness found on juries and the well-being of jurors that serve. Oregon voters who serve on juries have said for many years that the compensation they receive is inadequate. Oregon's extremely low jury fees send a message to jurors that their time and the function they perform is not that important or valuable. We should all be concerned about this, and the Access Committee hopes you will make some effort this session to start to increase compensation for jurors, especially those who do more than their civil duty by serving three or more days. Mr. Chair and Committee, another jury-related initiative that the Access Committee supports is the implementation of the one trial, one-day jury term length. With this term length, a juror serves on one trial, regardless of how long the trial lasts, or serves one day. When this term length has been implemented in other jurisdictions, juror satisfaction has improved and representativeness of panels has increased. However, due to the number of jurors summoned, this cannot be implemented in all Oregon counties, and there are some increased costs related to startup. The Lane County Courts and Bar are interested in implementing this term length there, and the Access Committee supports funding this effort. Kingsley Quick is available, Mr. Chair, to answer any questions you may have related to jury service in Oregon courts. As I move towards closure, the Access Committee also developed a proposal to develop model statewide forms and instructions for many court proceedings. Once model forms are developed, forms and instructions will be translated into Spanish, Russian, and Vietnamese by accredited translators. The proposal calls for the creation of dual language model forms for Spanish, English, Russian, English, and Vietnamese English, as well as finalizing all forms and instructions in alternative non-visual forms or formats to meet the needs of persons who are blind or visually impaired, for example, sound recordings, braille, and enlarged print. These non-English and non-visual formats will be distributed to each court location for distribution. In addition, the forms proposal includes adding all forms to the internet for the public and businesses to use as they conduct business with the court. Finally, the committee, the Access Committee, is also supportive of the Citizen Review Board increasing efforts to recruit and retain board members representative of the children being reviewed. And Tom Carranza is here today to talk about their initiative. Mr. Chair, I thank you for the time this afternoon and encourage your favorable consideration of the access to justice related efforts. And again, thank you.
Senator Gordley, I can assure you that this committee looks forward to receiving Senate Bill 71. That would be an integral part of our decision making. Any questions for the Senator with regard to this review board, the Access Committee? Senator? And we hope you're feeling better. I think we've all been through this. Some of us are on our second go.
Mr. Chair, I think we're about through with this aspect of it. I got a note from Kingsley saying afterwards, maybe mention some studies that are coming on. This was an umbrella of justice discussion we had 8 years ago, 7 years ago, and we are now jointly doing and cooperating with Orange State Bar on, they have a similarly named group called Access to Justice, dealing with legal services for the poor, and of course we're going to be involved in that, because that is a concern. I know that's a concern of the legislature over here. It's my intention in the out years as we move forward to do a study with, as it relates to the disabled, using, of course, ADA compliance. Also, age, at both ends of the spectrum, as you know, the juvenile area is growing by leaps and bounds. And also, elder care is becoming much more important as it surfaces, of course, through conservatorships, guardianships, and others. And so we're looking forward to making our goal. And I'm reminded, I've stolen this idea from somebody, but I think it accentuates the need for the courts to have access for all Oregonians. With your help and for something like this, it's not you and us, who, and it's not now. And that concludes that.
Okay,
I got to change my call.
What's the other?
Well, the other court issues, I'm going to touch 2 minutes each on... and maybe Bussman. On the remaining policy packages.
119, 118.
Revenues.
117.
We'll take a little longer. And then OJD bill, and then we'll wrap up. These are in, I call the master guide. Page 4, central packages facility. Heard from Wayne County yesterday, the new Justice Center, the money and the staffing, you need it now rather than a reservation to the board, because at least on the items, they can make significant savings by purchasing in bulk with the county. Marion County was here the other day to speak to us. I'm just going to mention there's a building going on for the Central Transit Mall, and when offices move around, they'll be remodeling the courthouse to provide more courtroom space, and that need is going to be moved in. I'm looking at Representative Mannix because I knew that he'd know that answer, but I believe they move in January 2001. That is money that we need this biennium, but we could come to an emergency board with the itemized cost on that when that comes a little closer. Umatilla, the same thing. They're in a major remodeling to give court space. As you heard testimony from Umatilla, if they got a new judge now, they have to put it in another city far away from where the center of cases are for them. With this remodeling project,
the money for the Portland space could be right there in Pendleton and Hermiston. The building, but that is something they said they could come to an e-board, but they do need the money to be able to do this during this biennium. Building services, the next three items, you see this totaled 1.4. You see on the front of the Chief Justice's one pager, we had 1 million. We cut some money out of this part and tried to pare it down just to the essentials. The number one essential is that the only is the heating system for the Supreme Court. DOS has taken away, the steam plant. We only have one building, that's the Supreme Court building. That steam plant feeds into the Supreme Court. You're going to get real grumpy to come about September. We can't buy them the boiler and do the wiring and the repairs needed to install the heating system. And I don't believe that DOS asked for that as any part of their budget on facilities, so, you know, because we own the building.
Is that different than he is in
The other parts of...
I didn't hear an answer to that.
I'm talking with my counsel.
Refuse to answer that on the basis.
The other part of building services also relates to the Supreme Court because it is the one building we own. It's a historic building, 84 years old,
Eighty-five
now. It needs caulking, it needs roof repairs, it needs fire escape rebuilds, and these monies are kind of one-time maintenance costs that otherwise we have a small maintenance budget that kind of takes care of the day-to-day packing down the carpet one more time sort of thing. So that's what's in the essential package on facilities that we didn't feel like we could... we had other choices
there. Can you say, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but what do you need gas for your heating plant?
May I?
Yes.
Sometime, I think in the late 30s, they built this huge water factory over here on Prairie and 12th, and it provided steam power for all the state government, our Supreme Court building, what used to be the state office building, and the Capitol. You had the foresight, I think it was 2 years or 4 years ago, to appropriate some dollars and cut yourself off the system. And so now you are not dependent, you're no longer dependent upon the central boiler and system over there, and you have central air conditioning, just a little shack with a jet between us and there. It must have been a major project because it took quite a bit of time. But now the Capitol building is no longer dependent upon the steam plant, and we are. And we were told, yes, I think you did it quietly. We were told, I think, in the last year or so that they are moving up, as I understand, the target date for just shutting it down. So they will not provide steam. So we've been trying to devise, and we are steam. Not air. I was careful back there. But we are a steam plant, or steam utilization for our heating system, and that's the genesis of this. That our boiler is going to be gone, and we'll need to replace it with one in the building.
I'm curious, Mr. Chairman. And are they just shutting down the plant, or are they simply just not providing the steam to your
building? Totally taking it out.
That's our understanding.
Scott Frampton, our management services person, this person who negotiates with DOS about that. But they gave us no
it wasn't your issue, except that you have to deal with the problem for your building. I was just curious as to why DOS is shutting it down. That's kind of the genesis of what I was getting at. Was
did you do something wrong?
They're on the wrong side or something.
I'm Scott Crampton, the Executive Management Services Director. The steam plant is being decommissioned by the Department of Administrative Services. It presently provides steam heat to a few facilities, the Supreme Court building, the Justice Building, LNI, and I think one other smaller building on that end of the Capitol Mall. All of those buildings will be putting in independent heating systems. As the Chief Justice indicated, they have moved up the time frame, and so we now have a truncated period with which to do this. What should be about a year-long project, we're going to have done by October when the heating season comes. As of 2 weeks ago, they indicated that the reason why they want to expedite this process is so that they do not have to maintain the steam plant for another heating season. So everybody is under the gun, including us, to get it done in that time frame.
They can close down for the prison there or something. Intake. Well, go ahead.
Well, I was struck that one of the other subcommittees is working with us with DOPS and Illinois. It also seemed to me that it was going to be appropriate for us to ask that other subcommittee to put more pressure on DOPS, not to put such untimely pressure on the Supreme Court, to give you some time, because if you have to rush a project like that, that means you often have to spend more money than you would if you were able to do it. Mr. Chairman, I would ask that we ask the city council staff to inquire about that and see whether or not there's such a problem keeping the plant open for another year so that this can be done in a more prudent fashion.
Wouldn't be fair,
Mr. Chair.
We just thought about 14 million and 4%. But we certainly look at that. Now, under this, it will be under the Supreme Court vote.
Yeah.
Be under the Supreme Court. Under the other, it was achieved by God, right?
Chair Turner, that's correct. We would own and maintain our own.
What the comparison cost?
It's actually more expensive for us to maintain our own than it would be to be a subsidiary user off the main plant.
That's the purpose of
golf. Yeah, Mr. Chairman. But as I understand, the answer is actually more expensive to go into the system. I wonder if we're going to hear that too from the folks in the LNI building.
Right.
So I just would ask if LFO.
I got
it. Well, the other thing is, how old the system the staff maintains and operates, and it's a project. You know, we do it for umpteen $1 million, and it's like, oops, let's kind of bite that bullet. Representative Shorter has been very patient.
Two questions. One that I want to, again, move the process, trying to get hit on. These are capital things, but they don't go in a capital budget because under a certain amount of dollars. Is that correct?
Okay.
I'm getting hit now. That's good enough. The other question is, I was understanding that the counties were to provide most of the, well, all of the facilities. I know there's a lot of discussion if that's good, bad, or different, but at this point in time, the counties provide the facilities, so I guess I'm wondering how come several counties are asking us to help with the facilities when we're supposed to be mostly the staff end of things.
Okay, last one, Representative Schrader.
We want the 5,000 word action, or less.
We provide everything from the bare walls and work as that Leonard was saying yesterday, we have to provide the chairs. We have to provide the courtroom diet. We have to propose to provide the sound system, the computer cable. And I can move on. The flag.
Yes. This is a never ending policy discussion. Or change them. That's where we're going. Thank you, sir.
Two other packages take plus. We will be coming back to these another way. We don't, except to answer questions, have to at this point come out in great depth. One is the 2020 Enterprise Incentive Account. It's Senate Bill 206 that's coming to you. But the concept is last state deck branch to have a productivity fund they've had for a number of years. Gives the judicial branch a chance to do the same thing where half the savings from innovations can be retained by the entity. Ours has a twist when you see that bill. It also allows us to use the money not just to fund efficiency but also to innovate. One of the big issues that came up through the Senate Interim Budget Committee hearings for us is the lack of discretionary funds to really talk things out and come to you with results to respond to emergencies in a timely fashion. So when you hopefully look at this bill, which is in Ways and Means, it was sent down here with a due path recommendation, then you can decide if it needs startup money or not. We put $2 million because last session that was about the amount of money that was added back to our budget in several areas. The concept itself doesn't require money. Seed money always helps. Policy Package 107, compensation issues. I know that comes down down the line and in the Ways and Means discussions. The reason we put it in our budget, we put in the money that's needed for judges and for staff. If there is a cost of living increase that is provided to state employees, we did it for two reasons. Actually, we did it for three reasons. We did it, one, because it's never fully funded by the legislature, and our share of what is funded is even less. While the debt branch may not have had trouble covering their costs last time for the unfunded part, the judicial department did. We not only had to put assessments on each of the counties to cut back that range from 1% to 2% of their budget, but they had to hold positions open longer than 6 months to come up with that money. And we're already talking about a court system that the staffing levels are not what they need to be. The other reason we put it in is because this time around we understand that if there's any number, it's probably going to be less than 50%. So we felt that the Chief Justice needs to have a number in his budget that says what does the judicial branch need if the legislature goes forward with compensation changes on behalf of the state government, and that would be a discussion you'll have later.
Can we have a rundown of what happened to you last session? I think it was $32 million, $60 million, and the governor updated for $92 million. So $32 million. This session, we just passed a bill with $40 million. I should probably double that. So we have some idea of how you made the cuts before, because here you're not planning on making the cuts within. You're asking for money for this cuts, right?
Chair Westland, Senator Kim, yes, we wanted to be able to...
All of the departments absorb the cost.
Right. We often absorb the second merit, second step of compensation changes, just at least in the way the legislature has addressed that in the past. We often have to also absorb any health increase costs that are passed on. So those are things traditionally that we absorb through vacancy savings or other force savings. The past several bienniums, when there has been cost of living, the amount provided has been less than 100%. The last biennium was basically 70 cents on the dollar. So that was about $3.5 million in our budget. We're still working on it. That by June 30th that we had to be out of operations, because you can't take it out of engine expense, you can't take it out of mandated, you can't take it out of judge's salary, constitutional provision, unless it needs to be balanced out of staff or S&S and capital. In our first presentation, we said S&S and capital was about 15%, not a lot of money there for discretion, and that's computer simple case files. So we've done it, but when we're looking at this biennium and we're hearing $40 million, that's 50% or less. And unfortunately, our distribution, while it may be fairly balanced, is balanced by DOT. So we feel the judicial branch, because we're smaller, we have less ability to absorb it, but at least make the case for its needs in that area. And I'm sure you'll have that discussion
for you. Good. Sure. Thank you. Vacancy. How many, what's your total FTE?
In the trial court, it's about 1139. In the whole county, the judges and staff, we're close to 1,600.
the
that includes the judges, so we've got about 181 positions.
Most of them, of course, for years, so we changed that system. States the pastor would probably pick up raises and everything in the process, and they have done away with that now, where it's a lot tougher than it used to be, especially for other departments. But you do have, you have to have some vacancies.
Can we, Chair Westland and Senator Kemp, we do report the vacancy factor, and I have to look it up, but we do have a vacancy factor that we do report and the LFO. And also last time on our subcommittee, because we have traditionally, like other agencies, balanced a lot of things through vacancy savings, they look at what positions we have held open longer than 6 months, and they scalped out 3 or 4 positions out of the court last time around because they had been held open for and not used, mainly because they're being used to balance for other needs. So,
who scalped that money?
Those tough people and co-chair.
LFO.
A very good person.
We may have to scalp the
No, it's legitimate that permanent financing should be there for people to use. The tradition, however, until last biennium was that if you held on to that money that came with those, you could use them for other purposes. And in those courts that were scrambling, they used them for temporary, because temporary staff is cheaper than permanent, and they used them to buy computers and other things that they needed. But we did lose positions in what we call the Saturday night.
Any other questions on salary compensation, school increases, judges' compensation?
Three other items before we get to closing. We don't have to, but I didn't lose revenues. Actually, there's this golden rod. I took a copy before we made the pretty covers. Revenues from state court system, this will probably come back to during work session discussion, but what I've given you is information on our revenue type, where we generate revenue from. On page 3 of it, a short couple of paragraphs on our revenue history. I do want to note that our revenues projected for 9901 are estimated to be 136.5 million. This is an increase of 23% from the amount actually received for 95-97, and it's a 19% increase from what we're estimating or have estimated for this biennium. We've attached several things that show the revenue projections, including answering your question, Senator Timms, about the changes to the filing fees and collections staff. As background, since 94, we put in place a policy to improve collections for the Chief Justice Carson established a statewide policy that we had an obligation to the court system to actively collect our accounts receivables. It also stressed judges' increasing role in sentence enforcement. It happened to dovetail nicely with the fact that we were going to an automated financial information tracking system, because as you heard Carl Ward testify, we couldn't tell you what was happening statewide with revenues or trust. You had to go into each county and look in the ledger book or to the program they had. You also, the last three biennium, passed a number of changes in state laws that allowed public collection efforts to be done more easily. You also funded a court collections unit and Department of Revenue for delinquent accounts when we refer them over. What you did last biennium in our budget, you gave us 20 general funded positions that cost $1.2 million to improve what I would call the immediate collection efforts of the courts before they become delinquent. Those staff, they set up payment schedules, they actively pursue the collections, they're also actively involved in the immediate referral of those accounts once they become delinquent and kind of have the court's ability to handle them. We had estimated that if we had the 20 collection staff that they could, their cost of $1.2 million, they could return approximately $5 million, we thought, in the additional collection effort. Attachment D
goes through how we think the results are, that they are collecting $6.4 million if we follow our current trends.
Collecting how much?
$6.4 million more devoted just to them because of part of this, because of the fee increases, but also because of collection of people being able to be there and actively pursue, and also because through technology we now set up a number of electronic transfers, so that cuts down on a lot of problems with immediate entry and immediate transfer over. We also have contracts with third parties, with private collection agencies. Postal is the main one. So we've tried to take, we still have other things we can do, but we've tried to take a number of approaches in improving the collections that are coming into the state. Now, you know, a lot of what we collect, only part of it goes to the general fund. A number of it goes to the criminal fines and assessment accounts, which funds a number of separate states and local and policies. So we also fund citizens and county revenues because they have a cut of the revenues we bring in. Attachment F, I thought, was interesting because we had...
Hold on a second, can you... How much of that 6.4 is directly attributable to the additional collection efforts as opposed to just fee increase, fine increase?
If that is a little hard to say with preciseness, we believe the 6.4, that at least half of that is attributable to the collection staff. Just looking at kind of one, you know, bringing in a dollar for every dollar that it costs to run them. I think it's more than that, but that's hard to precisely identify because of some of the state filing increases. The chart on attachment B does show where the different revenue increases came from, and that's where I want to look at. Cutting some for the, because even though you increase the filing fees or fine amounts, you still have to collect them because the number of payments are deferred, including filing fees, and we also go after those once the case is closed and collecting that deferred.
So let's just make the assumption of that, and excuse me, I think you said this number, but it's slipped my mind. If that's 3.2, then additional, so I'm switching number. How much did it cost to collect that?
1.2.
So we functionally got a 275% return on our investment. Where do we reach a diminishing point of returns in terms of personnel to enhanced collections?
Sure, Westland, that's a good question. I think with technology we can do more with staff. We can look at that a little more because not all the courts got full peak bodies and not all the courts got bodies because they already had converted for other staff to collections efforts. So we mostly beefed up where there were no collections staff at all. I know Ernie Maswell can speak to what happened in Deschutes just when they went from having no one to someone. And we can give you a little more information on that. What I did in the attachment, and then I'll move off from this, we did give a summary of an information set of what all our revenues are from in attachment C. Are the projected court revenues for 9901 that were part of the governor's revenue figure, but we're projecting to bring in 130.8. I can only tell you we always try to be conservative. We don't like to bring in less money than we project. In attachment C2, I thought it was interesting because some of our color printer to work again, to show you just more graphically where our revenues go to, are distributed. Then attachment P3 is the detailed breakdown item by item of where the 9901 projections come from. So if you were to change any feature in it, we might be able to project how much increased revenue would come from changing that particular feature. We weren't able to do that the biennium before. We tweaked our financial system this time around to be able to give this kind of detail. So we talked about is where I think the $6.4 million came from. He shows you just the Department of Revenue collection history. They take a percentage. They are underfunded from our money that we turn over. They fund their units to support it to increase revenue. It's dramatic. The unit came in from the 95 session, and you can see what difference it made having dedicated support staff and units and revenue.
Let me interrupt you, Representative Schrader. It's on this line of discussion, and I've been looking. Looks very good. It's going up, and I had somewhat the same question that Representative Wilson Shore recommended, as far as you know how much of it was fine increase in fines versus maybe there's another way to get at it. It goes back to a discussion Representative Patridge had regarding what have the sentences called for as far as fines. And then what has actually been assessed, if you will, and then that, and maybe a trend over a few years, a few biennia, that would help us get a feel for the efficiency too, I think.
Chair Lesham, Representative Schrader, we can't go very far back to look at that because we didn't have the financial automated system. We can perhaps go back. I know this biennium we have some information in, I believe, the biennium before, and then I'm not sure about right before that.
That'd be great.
What you did hear from the judges is they have to individually assess a person's ability to pay when they come in front of them. So, and then even though they assess they have the ability to pay, being able to help them make those payments is an additional effort.
So, I mean, obviously, I mean, we're trying to scrape every penny we can off the, you know, bottom of a mud-covered barrel here. It's too much of a stretch to say with your 1.2, you got $3.2 million. It's too much of a stretch to say if we pay you $12 million, you'd get $32.
Your weapon, probably.
But probably.
Well, I never say never until I go back and look at the premises.
You're telling me you haven't explored an opportunity to pick up $20 million?
Well, that's not until I know we must spend it.
Sorry,
Chair.
Oh,
I'm
sorry. You're in trouble.
You know? We're a thief.
You know this person?
Yeah.
Chair Weston, actually, it's because we're still working on that issue.
Yes, yes. And unrelated, but kind of related, indigent defense. I saw you'd collected $5.6 million worth of indigent defense. Let me not go there.
We do have information.
That's a conversation for another day. Anyway, please proceed.
On that same attention, it was the third party collection history, and that just shows you how that was progressing. And usually they get ones that are either under the amount, and I think it's under 50 that DOR won't pick, or they get ones that are what we call the poor debt accounts that no one else is having luck with. Attachment F, I wanted to bring your attention to, and then it's also part of the narrative on page 4 at the conclusion. We spoke to the fact that the department actually pulled in revenues from all sources, approximately 73.4% of the general fund's trial court operations appropriations. With our recent projections, it looks to take in overall 93.48% of those trial court operations costs. You're just looking at equivalent for 97.99. Now, if you take out the money that goes to other state entities, local entities, and private entities, and just look at the general fund part, it's certainly much less because our main obligation of money goes to other places. But we've increased it to 36% for 97-99 compared to 31% in 95-97, and that's what the appropriations costing more. So I know in work session,
we have two very distinguished people that need to make a presentation.
We also gave you a new update, lest you forget where we are in the general fund. We used to be 4.4% of your general fund budget in 91. Now we're down below 3.60. He did an updated chart. The one in the budget document was from 97-99 because we did that before we knew the governor's numbers. So we gave him some scenarios. So that is in I gave you and I also passed out an updated other funds, federal funds in session, work session, because we had some drug court grants and a couple other items that have changed what our limitations need to be, but we do that usually in work session, so we'll talk about that then. You asked for, we have a handout that provides the Judicial Department bills that are in ways and means. You've been hearing bits and pieces that all on one page are parts of the chief deficit budget that involve legislative proposals and that are on ways and means. On the next page are ones that are all our bills, and a few more of those may still come down there too, because we have another week before everything has to be out there. You also asked a number of questions during our hearing. We just passed, at the very bottom should be a handout that says schemes reflected from Monica Melhorn. I passed her in my office was pulling together all the pieces to answer the specific questions that had come up, and if we've forgotten any, that lets us know, we'll provide those pieces. You may want to talk to those more when we get to the back to work session. Then we did do a look at all the fiscal bills that are out there, but when we go to work session, we can tell you what the number of costs are on the court from this legislation going through. So with that, Chair Westland, we're ready to make closing remarks unless you would like us to do something.
Two very distinguished individuals have cut 12 minutes in the two very distinguished individuals' closing comments. I know I and several other committee members have to be out here right at 3 o'clock. Or in the words of that esteemed chair, go.
Closing remarks. I grew up in a military family in the 1950s and 60s. About half that time, we spent overseas in other countries. We were stationed in Germany when the Berlin Wall went up and when the Berlin crisis was going on. It was a scary time for us. It was a scary time for the world. We take more for granted in just one day in this country than others even have a chance to take for granted in a lifetime. I'm not talking about material things. I'm talking about freedom. I'm talking about democracy. I'm talking about justice. Do not take for granted the treasure you have in the Oregon State Court system. It should be protected, fought for, and applauded. The question of approving the Judicial Department's budget request should be a no-brainer all the way around. Where else in the entire system are you going to be able to affect meaningful change in 20% of the children and families that create 80% of the headaches and 80% of the cost? To turn this around will cost you less than 4% of the general fund budget. Where else in state government have you seen such motivated and passionate leaders? Where else have you heard that service hours get reduced, but physicians are cobbled together again and again to try and provide the public services of greatest need and use? You get value from your court system, I would say 10 times over, from its ingenuity and its fidelity to its mission. You ask how to need for fewer judges and reduce the caseload, but don't do it by fragmenting the justice delivery system. Do it by consolidating cases and by funding better outcomes. fund the course budget, and children will have a chance for a safe and stable home in months, not years. Families in conflict will have an integrated service plan that supports their success. If this happens, maybe they won't have to be back as cases again and again. Fund the course budget, and access to the course through technology will be available for over 3 million Oregonians. Even more important, judges will have the data and costs and tools to make more effective decisions. If this happens, maybe those people won't have to be back as cases again and again. Fund the court budget, and ADR and Community Dispute Resolution Center will exist in every county. People not only will have options to costly litigation, they will learn the tools to resolve their own disputes. Maybe if this happens, they won't have to be back as cases again and again. Fund the court budget, and you will have funded prevention, accountability, and results. You are worrying for good reason about funding levels for K through 12. But what good is a new textbook to a kid if his parent is a drug addict, if he is starving, if she is being beaten every day? If the school refers these matters to the authorities, where do you think they have to go to? They have to go to the court to take any legal action to make any change in this child's life. How can you not fund the courts to deal with these families and children effectively? I can't think of a better place to put your money for greater system-wide good and cost avoidance. If you fund the children that come before the Oregon courts, you really will change the future. If courts are not funded, will the universe fail? No. Will the good parts of the universe fail? Yes. So will the good parts of the thousands of tiny universes fail? Those universes of the children and the tattered lives that come before the court, expecting justice, expecting fairness, expecting timely justice. We are primarily asking for resources to do yesterday's work for the increased caseload demands created by society and created by new legislation. We are asking for only a small stipend of resources to do tomorrow's work, to fund the innovations we have begun in our criminal courts, our family courts, in ADR, and in another area. You need to understand that I believe the courts hold the key to the better Oregon future. If we don't do our job, no one is safe. If we don't do our job, other agencies and branches of government spend more tax dollars dealing with troubled children and families. If we don't do our job, violence only increases, stability declines, society further disintegrates. We are not asking for fluff. We are asking for the basic necessities to do this critical job and to do it right. And it will not cost this little to ever do this much again. Thank you.
I debated, Mr. Chairman. I brought this up when we started. Throughout the 2 weeks, I'm not sure it made an impression, so I decided to bring it back and don it. I want to thank the committee. I don't think there's a finer committee based on what I know in the legislature today, and there are many good people serving in the legislature than you have, Mr. Chairman, with this committee here. You've been attending, and you've been attentive, and I appreciate it. One of the things that kind of nagged on me, I went back through all my notes to make this close. There were some disconnects. One, a policy discussion occurred and reoccurred. I'll state my view, and that is, the sense of it was, to me, was, well, who's making policy? The answer's pretty easy. First, the people of Oregon in their Constitutional Convention in 1857 set the basic policy. And it had been amended by referral from this body and also by initiative. But the Constitution is the policy setter for what we do. And I might add for what you do and what the executive does as well. And the statutes. We're not a volunteer organization. That doesn't sound very well, but we do what you tell us to do. And as I mentioned earlier, while we're in the here talking about budget dollars, I can assure you we have over 3,100 bills, I understood, in the last week have been introduced. And a good hunk of them last time. There are about 3,500, and 1,900 of the 3,500 have some impact on the judicial system. Some from just a blow-by to
very significant cases. We're talking about today, I have no idea what's going on. Well, we do, because that's one of the first staff. I have no idea, but she does. The creative aspects of other members of the body in deciding more things for us to do. Will they be connected up with budget? Not based on past records. They'll just skate right on through. So, and then thirdly, constitutional statutes and budget. There's real policy. And I don't think I'm telling any party in this group. I pay as much attention to the budget notes as I do the statute. Why? Because we'll have to be back. And if you don't follow your budget notes, I mean, it's just a little, here's a little note, we understand. I understood when I was here. Those are key. And you expect them to be followed, and we know you do, and we try. I, as a symmetry wonk, I guess I would say, picked up some feeling that some of you are concerned that there seems to be a lot of symmetry in what we do. Well, duh. We're working on our Constitution. It started out 11,000 words, and now it's over 22,000 words, and is amended every time you turn around. We have stuff in our Constitution cities don't even have in their ordinances. But that's the Oregon way. So, yeah, a little disconnect. Have you ever tried to find a concordant note to our Constitution? Or to, I'll say, our statutes? Good luck. So, sure, there's a lack of symmetry. There's a history of Oregon. I'm very proud of that history. We're not so... Oregon's diverse. Oregon takes a great deal of pride on local government, local control. And I'm very proud of that. And dollars make some lack of symmetry out there. Sometimes they're funded and sometimes they're not. So you're on again, off again. Preference this direction, preference that direction. And one of the things I'm very proud of, and it makes being a chief administrative head over 181 independently, 180 independently elected judges, which is kind of an oxymoron, I think, is our sensitivity to local culture. This body, I don't have to explain it to you, but you know there's a difference between Burns and Portland. These are different. It ought to be, and we're here to maintain it. And we're not trying to jam down the Portland model down the Kearney County model, or vice versa. So there is a lack of symmetry. We don't do things in Klamath Falls like we do in Salem. And you would not want us to. And more importantly, people in Klamath Falls don't want us to. So I'm sorry that we have perhaps a policy discussion, but I feel somewhat of a captive in that it ain't our fault. We're trying to respond to the written word. Again, thanks to the committee. If there's a failure to adequately engage the committee on the level that you want to engage on, I apologize for that. It's my fault. We've tried to figure out, I haven't been doing this very long. I think this is third.
Yeah, the first is in
Southwest. Yeah, whatever. Session. But we've been changing our approach trying to meet what we think we hear from you that you want to have us explain. A lot of talking heads, a lot of numbers, maybe not enough engagement, but that's my fault. It certainly isn't Kingsley, and I will say that she is the most able administrator with whom I've ever had the pleasure of working. And I got an easy job. And she does a marvelous job. So if we fail to engage you, I apologize for that. I know you have concerns. We try to comply with the different references. We changed our whole approach this year from 2 years ago because we were told in no uncertain terms that our approach last time was not what the committee wanted after we've been using it for 6 years. It kind of dawned on us, well, maybe that's why we're having some trouble. It isn't what the committee wanted. We will critique, as this session is over, how we can do a better job. Because even if it's going back to Senator Tim's concern, if you understand who we are, or how we work, or why we work, we're dead in the water. We're not going to get anything. And I hope you take the hard remarks of State Court Administrator. We've been focusing on figures, numbers. That's kind of, I thought, what we were about. But they lack pizzazz, they lack passion, they lack political sense, but please don't forget that we're talking about people. As Kingsley so eloquently stated, behind every one of those numbers, whether it's a dollar or a case, there are people back behind there. People we care about and people you care about. They're the people you represent. I referred to my opening remarks that Senator Farrelly suggested that maybe I do something like this, because there is some disconnect, not with this committee, but generally. Down here is like the Parks Department, and so we don't open a park or two, it's not going to make any difference and go to another park. I didn't want to work that. I hope we've made that point. Most of you know that. All of you know that. I did receive a memo from a longtime friend and staff colleague who was, in very general terms, a little critical of us for focusing on numbers while we're going through this and not letting you know what this really makes a difference. So let me quote from part of it, and I'll be brief. We record a unique position in this society, and I'm paraphrasing in some respects. No one could get a restraint order without coming through us. No one can get a divorce without coming through us. A child cannot be placed in a safer environment without our consent. A bad person cannot be taken off the street and placed behind bars without our consent. The things we do affect people, much as the things you do affect people. Hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people. We have the responsibility to see the laws are enforced fairly, and that everyone has a level playing field, and we cannot do that with inadequate resources. I hope that's obvious. These are statistics drawn from this source. I trust the source. I didn't go back and check them out. But for instance, instead of stating that we have X number of cases, why not state that we had 5,669 mental cases filed last year in the state of Oregon? And I had a black belt in Chapter 426 and 427 mental hearings when I was in Marion County. I was the one that, more in Multnomah County, but with all the institutions we had here, we did a lot of those. These are real people, I can assure you that. And they have real problems. But don't stop there with just 5,600. I think you need to go forward to the effect they have in the community. They don't go away unless you find them mentally ill and in danger to themselves or danger to others, unable to provide their own personal needs. I'm running out of time. In 1998, there were 64,677 felony cases, numbers again, filed in circuit court in our state. But that represents 64,000 situations where it was reported that a major law, a law that you had passed, or your predecessors, was violated. Not only did it affect the lives of those 64,000 individuals, or in groups, maybe less, it affected the safety and security of all 3.2 million of our citizens. In 1998, there were 2,164 juvenile petitions filed with the Circuit Court in the state of Oregon. How many families does this involve? Many. You determine how long you want a child to wait until the court can determine if they should be removed from an abusive situation. You decide when a youth offender should be removed from the street. Power is in your hands. Every morning, we have hundreds of people appearing to secure a restraining order around the state. A large number of these people come with injuries suffered the night before. They've been beat on. They need protection. We passed the FAPA law in 1977. It was a good law. It's time-consuming and resource-heavy. They need protection that only the court can provide through the restraining order. How does it play if we tell these people their situation is bad, but there are hundreds of other situations around the state like that and in this court, and they'll just have to wait this time? Because we don't have the staff or the judges to deal with it. These are real people, and they have real problems, and the court has a role with your help. The problems are increasing. Let me close with two quotes. You're familiar with both of them. In our Oregon Constitution, Article 1 is the Bill of Rights, Section 10. It gives us part of our charge. No court shall be secret, but justice shall be administered openly and without purchase, completely and without delay. And every man shall have a remedy by due course of law for the injury done him in his person, his property, or his reputation. That's one of our charges. And finally, I think most of you are aware of it, when H.B. Alexander pulled together the inscriptions that are scattered around your building here, he was a Scripps College professor. In 1937, 38, when they built this building, and there are several around. Well, the one I'm my most favorite quote, you've seen it many times, and I'd ask if you go by the Rotunda and look up there and think about the role the Judicial Department plays in bringing this goal, this hope of Oregonians to reality. It's called on the governor's balcony. You stand down by the state seal and look up for the governor's office. In the souls of its citizens will be found the likeness of the state. But which, if they be unjust and tyrannical, then will it reflect their vices. But if they be lovers of righteousness, confident in their liberties, so will it be clean in justice and bold in freedom. That's our shared challenge. I thank you for your time, and I thank you for your patience in the last 2 weeks. We're at your service now and hereafter. Thank you.
Thank you. Do not take for granted. Just, we are here.